Hello again, Bob Chaundy here with another Considering Art podcast, in which I talk to an artist about their work and something of their life. Caroline Burraway is a multimedia and multi-talented artist whose work centres on people from the margins of our society, those that live behind closed doors in closed worlds. They include the disenfranchised and the displaced. Her aim, she says, is to take you kicking and screaming into a world that you would otherwise turn away from. Since 2015, Caroline has trained her focus on the refugee crisis and has gathered source material from camps in Greece and France. Her visits there have produced memorable artworks. Her installation called Ungrievable Lives saw her hang children's dresses that she made herself out of life jackets worn by refugees and asylum seekers trafficked across the Mediterranean. It's been shown internationally. And her charcoal drawing of a displaced Eritrean woman called Eden at the jungle camp in Calais won Caroline the prestigious Trinity Boy Wharf Drawing Prize in 2018. And anyone visiting the recent John Ruskin Prize exhibition in London will have noticed her poignant large-scale triptych that Caroline has drawn of a refugee from Syria called Tariq. Red threads, which she pinned onto the drawings, trace the convoluted route he had taken before reaching sanctuary in Europe. It was at that exhibition that I began by asking Caroline to tell me Tariq's story.
Tariq is a Syrian refugee I met in the camps in Greece. I've been working on the refugee crisis since 2015. So I've been travelling around Europe in all the different camps, started off in France in the jungle, Grand Synthe and other camps further into France, and wondered where the women and children were. So took myself off to Greece, met Tariq in Athens. He'd come from the smaller camp on Chios. And then I went further into Lesbos, which we can talk about later. So Tariq was part of Assad's army, and he tried to run away because of all the rapes and murders of the children and all the things that were happening. And so they shot him in the back, and they strung him up for 25 days, and they tortured him with knives, and they threw freezing cold water over him every day. And then eventually he got money from his family and bribed them to let him go. And then he ran away again. And he was then captured by Daesh and was held for interrogation. And then a bomb fell on the building where he was being held. And he escaped and he managed to get over to Lebanon. And then he came back through a people trafficker who was actually part of the Syrian army, who took him back to Damascus, then up to Turkey. Then to Izmir, the border. He then tried attempts across the sea. And on the 10th attempt, he managed to get over to Chios. And from there, was then taken to Athens. And from there, he got his papers and eventually flew to Belgium, where he was reunited with his family after 10 years.
So you met him in Greece, but you flew to Belgium with him, I gather.
Yeah, so I met him in the camps. I tend to go and sort of go into the camps and take sort of general footage of what's going on, the way people are living, and then try and focus on individuals as well that want to work with me, because I think it's such a vast subject. If you look at the thousands and thousands, you also need to look at the individual to give a face, if you like, for people to be able to hold on to and see that these are people, they're not just statistics. So Tariq was really interesting and a really nice young guy. And what he'd been through is what many have been through, you know, the refugees that get there. But there was just something about him. And I went and did video work with him for about a week, and then went back home. And then he contacted me and said he got his papers. So I flew back out and I got on the flight with him to Belgium. And then when I was in the airport, they have armed guards, right, going around because you're not meant to video. So like, as soon as they were out the way, we came through and got the most amazing footage of when he met his family, especially his mum. And then was bundled in a car with them and taken off somewhere into Belgium. And they had big kind of family. And that was after actually the police tried to take the footage at the airport. But anyway, yeah. So all good.
So you're dicing with security.
No, it was fine. I mean, you know, and he's just really interesting. And then the thing about the video work, the way the drawings work are taken from frames from my video work, so that I work with a series of frames and of the people I meet. So they're not just from a photographic source. And the reason I work as sort of multidisciplinary is that my first degree was drawing, but at Camberwell, but I ended up working with video. And then I went into do my MA at Central St. Martin's with video work. And then they didn't like the work I was doing. They found it very difficult. So they took the work in front of an ethics committee to see if they could kind of stop it being shown. So I decided, okay, fine, I am going to do these massive drawings, like these 6-foot drawings, and they're going to smack you in the face and you're not going to be able to stop me doing it and you're not going to be able to not look at them. And then it made me realize that they're very different mediums and they allow people to engage and see in different ways.
What were their complaints then?
I had been working on a really long-term project with a very old lady the last 4 years of her life, up to and including her death. So when I went in to do my master's, I continued working with that footage. And it was just really difficult footage. It wasn't anything sensational. It was just life in sort of residential and care homes. And I'd had an honorary fellowship with the Observatory on End-of-Life Care, which is based at Lancaster Uni, because they understood the power of art when you're dealing with difficult subjects to engage people. And they didn't like it. And it was just, the video is often, they're more like little bits of poetry. Very little is said, if anything. And they're often what I call moving stills. There's very little happens.
Did they dislike it because it was something private, that you were robbing her of her dignity and that sort of thing?
There was that in it. I think that the head of the MA, her husband had died, and the tutor, her mother, was suffering from dementia in her home. So I think on a sort of personal level, it was quite difficult. And it's quite voyeuristic because you are sort of looking through a peephole, if you like, into somebody else's like a life that, but, you know, we are hiding these, you know, the joke is we're living longer, we're keeping people alive longer. But I thought, well, we don't want to see them though. We're hiding them behind sort of screens and white walls. And we just sort of put them there because, you know, we can, and it makes us feel less guilty. But their lives, it's not that they're being ill-treated, but it's just a sort of an insidious kind of neglect. And I feel that art has the power to engage people and make them look at things they perhaps don't want to see.
Well, you've spent a lot of your career dealing with subjects that people prefer not to see. And there's a humanitarian compassion as a theme in your work. Where did that come from, Caroline? Was it a familial trait?
It's always, my work has always been around the displaced and the disenfranchised, always. And I've always set up my own projects.
But why?
I don't know. I think people often don't put me with my work. I don't know. I've always felt slightly like an outsider myself. And I've always felt that when I go into these spaces and I'm talking with the people, they're as much a part of the work as I am. It's a collaboration between us. But I feel, you know, working with vulnerable people in these spaces is actually really difficult. And one has to question constantly the morals and ethical consideration of what you're doing and why you're doing it. And that becomes part of the work. I've always believed that one should see reality, the real, you know, try and put yourself into someone else's shoes. And most people will never go to these places and never experience this. So for myself as the artist, it's important I go to them. I have a tiny, tiny understanding of what's going on and then bring that back with me to try and show the people that will never go there.
I wonder why you feel that you're an outsider.
I don't know. It's just when you're young, you're just shy and just don't fit in. And art is different. I feel I fit in. So it's the only place I felt I fit in, really. Yeah.
You deal with socio-political conflicts. There's a series you did called The Grey Zone, pictures of people in Syria and Iraq who have been tortured or killed in chemical attacks, and your approach to those was to sort of corrupt photos. Can you explain what exactly it was?
Yeah, the Grey Zone, it's actually an ongoing project which I've been doing for years, and it's based on Goya's Disasters of War. So I take the Disasters of War and use the composition, if you like, and put it into a contemporary, because these things are still going on. And so I take many different photographs or video footage, frames from video, and I put them together, and then I put them sort of into Photoshop. I'll work out a sort of an image, if you like, and then I take it out and I print it out, and then I work on it with pencils, inks, anything, bleach, whatever. So that's, but it's funny you should ask about that, because I often bring up that piece of work. But I did a talk just recently for Drawing Projects UK, and one of the people had said to me that she'd looked at my website and seen the Grey Zone works and thought how beautiful it was until she realized what she was looking at and was horrified that she could think something so awful could be beautiful. And that is actually a part of the work. And you know, should one, if you're using beauty about something that is an atrocity, why? Is it the right thing to do? Is it a way, or is it sort of a way to engage people that they otherwise would turn away from it? And for me, the viewer is the most important thing. Without the viewer, the work doesn't exist. The viewer completes the work, if you like. So if they're not able to spend time with it, then it can't do its job. It can't engage you with what you're looking at. You know, what is it trying to say to you?
I'm interested in that aspect, the viewer. You deal with a lot of migrants, Tarek for one, and Eden was another person that you did who won you the Trinity Boy Wharf Drawing Prize. Yeah. Yeah, it used to be the Jerwood. It's a lot easier to say Jerwood, isn't it?
Yeah, AKA.
But there's a strong opinion in Europe and elsewhere that why should we take migrants in, both illegal or legal, when we have beleaguered social services, our national health services under pressure, and, you know, there are shortage of housing? I mean, what do you say to them?
I mean, I understand that. And I think that unfortunately, worldwide, you know, the rise of populism and sort of the way it's encouraging a fear of the other is a huge problem and becoming more so. And I think all I'm trying to do is, these are just people, these are just kids, and wherever they're from doesn't matter. And the fact that, yeah, we have issues in this country and all other countries, but what does that mean? That we just put up our borders and let them drown? That's not part of being human. I just want people to understand when they see these things, that these are just people that are in desperate situations. They're not getting on those boats because they want to. They're doing it because they feel they have no choice. You know, I have kids. I would not put them on one of those boats unless I felt I had absolutely no other choice. They're just people. And I know it's not a very popular thing to be working on at the moment, and there's a huge backlash against it all, but I think it's important. And for me, I want you to look at it, and I want you to think about what it's going to say.
Do you think, though, the people who need to look at it are the ones that actually do?
Well, I think so if you keep the art within the art world, you know, in the gallery space, and then no, I think you're preaching to convert it and everyone agrees, and it has to go beyond that. It has to go into the public spaces where actually you're trying to engage with people that don't think the same way. And that is really important, because actually if people think about these things, I think that we share a lot. There are more, you know, shared core beliefs between us all, regardless of where we come from, what language we speak. There's much more that actually is similar with us if we can just look at it that way. I mean, one of the projects I did, it was an installation that was in Holland Park and then has just been in UNESCO in Italy in human rights exhibition. And it was huge photographs of many of the children I met in the camps. And for once, there was a lot of colour, and they're just kids. And you didn't know where these kids came from. That was the point. It could be, you know, my kid, your kid, any child. And they have the same hopes and dreams of the future that all children have. And we shouldn't look at them and think, oh, well, they don't belong here because, you know, they're just children.
One of your memorable installations is called Ungrievable Lives, in which you made 13 children's dresses and you hung them up from weighing hooks. They represented the 13 million, as then, refugees, children refugees in the world. How did it come about?
Yeah. So I'd ended up this was just before COVID struck. I'd ended up in Lesbos in Moria, and Moria was the worst refugee camp in Europe. It was horrendous. The conditions were absolutely awful. There were, I think, 9,000 people there by the time I last went, and there should have been 3,000. And then there was a huge fire, actually, I think in 2021, and it burnt down. But when I was there, I went to the refugees, the Life Jacket Graveyard, which is kind of in the north of the hills of Lesbos. And it's basically a rubbish dump. And it's sort of, you walk to the end of this crevasse. And when I looked down, there were thousands upon thousands upon thousands of life jackets, mountains of them. And it was like literally being physically punched in the stomach. And I looked at it and I knew I had to do something with it. I didn't know what I was going to do, but I knew I had to try and do something. So I collected hundreds of life jackets, and you're not actually meant to be there, by the way, or go there, so don't do this, and managed to get them back to London, which is a whole different story, which I won't go into now. And then COVID struck and I couldn't go back. And so I emptied out hundreds of life jackets on the floor in my studio, and I just thought, well, you know, what can I do with this that people will immediately be able to see and will touch? Because I think when you go to a piece of art, any of us go to a piece of art, we have to see something of ourselves, of our own small history within it, in order for it to touch us in some way. And so the dresses, so I unpicked in all of the life jackets, the children's life jackets, and stitched them back together again as little sort of three-year-old dresses. I've got four kids. I've got three girls. I've worked with dresses before. I think on first sight, you see them and you think, oh, little child's dress, you know, oh, that my child. And you see that. And then as you go closer, you realize that they're patched together of all these life jackets. And, you know, they have the names stamped on them of the countries they've come from. So then I did 13 for 13 million children pre-Ukraine. I hung them on old sort of scales because the scales are basically asking the question, you know, what is the difference between the life of the refugee child compared with the life of the Palestinian child? So it's that sort of hitting the knives in the balance. And they're on a bed of sand, which is not because they landed on the sand. The sand stands for sort of, you know, the political borders, which are forever moving. Look at Russia, Ukraine, cultural borders, and obviously real borders.
Which are shifting often.
Always shifting and moving. So that everything that's used in that installation is a signifier of something. And then I was working with Charlotte Bray, British composer, on a different project. And she called me one evening and she said, Caroline, I can't stop thinking about the dresses. And I've composed her first string quartet made of 13 miniature movements. And this was then taken on by a lot of big opera houses and music houses across Europe and beyond, actually. It's gone to America now as well. And it's been traveling. So with the installation, because the two together are so powerful, you know, in their own right they are. But when you put them together, and I've never worked with someone else before, so it's been really interesting. Because you as a human, you're touched by everything. It's not just sight, it's what you hear around you. And they just have a power about them. And it started off at the Elbe Philharmonie in Hamburg and then went to Wigmore Hall, Oxford Uni, Vienna Concert House. It's going off to, hopefully this year it's going to go to the Concert House in Berlin. And it's been amazing. It's beautiful. It's when it was in New Chapel at Oxford University, it made you know, your hair stand on you. It was beautiful.
You won the Trinity Boy Wharf Drawing Prize for Eden. You found her in the jungle, the camp for refugees in Calais. What was she like and how did the camp strike you?
The camp was actually nothing like I thought it was going to be. It had quite a sense of camaraderie about it in a way. People had come together from all these different countries around the world. And yes, they were sort of separated into, you know, one part where the Syrians were, but actually they all came together in the cafes and the sort of, you know, shops that they'd, it was more like a little town that they built there. There was a real sense of living going on there, very different to somewhere like Moria, where they were given food just to sort of sustain them, but there was no, they were just waiting there and being sort of given, you know, things from the UN, but there wasn't a sense of any kind of life or any purpose. So it was quite different. Mm. And Eden was one of the few women I met and one of the few that would actually engage with me.
And what happened to her?
She actually did manage to get to England.
Good.
Yeah. Her sister's here somewhere.
It's important for you, I think, to get to know the people before you convert them into art, so to speak. How do you get over that feeling? I've had it once or twice that you're a middle-class white person. They are desperate and you've got all the agency. They haven't. You'll go back to your soft bed and they'll go back to their flimsy tent or whatever. It's a difficult one, isn't it?
Yeah, it's incredibly difficult because, you know, people say to me, oh, you must be like going there. Oh, it's so amazing. And it's so this and that. And I think, no, actually it isn't, because I know at the end of the day, I can go back to my bed and they can't, they're stuck there. And obviously one doesn't want to feel like, you know, the white crusader on your horse coming in and do, but at the end of the day, most of the people in that situation have not got the time to try and do anything about trying to bring awareness to their situation. They're just trying to survive within it. And I have the means and the ability to try and do something. And it is hard. And I know exactly what you're saying because you do feel it. But, you know, that's for good or bad. That is my background. I could have been, you know, we could all be a refugee. You know, I come from refugees. We could all be there. And just like that, we can all be there as well. So I just try and do the little I can, and I feel that art is a really powerful means to allow that.
Let's look at another couple of your works. Mother was a reaction to the Ukraine war. You have a mother's breast above a canister of oil. What's the meaning behind that?
Yeah, so Mother hasn't been shown anywhere, and I'm not sure anyone will ever show it. But, you know, I was on my run. I go for a run every morning, and which is a good time for me to really think about things. And it was when the war had just started, and it was obviously all about the oil and the gas. And I just sat by the river, and I thought, you know, what can I do? A piece, what can I do about this in some sort of insulation that would make sense? And I thought, okay, I need to get a Russian oil drum. So I went, you know, Googled, and of course there are no Russian oil drums. And then weirdly, there was this Russian oil drum on eBay.
Like, yeah, chances. So often happens you get anything on
chances.
eBay.
So I immediately bought it, and it turned up, and it's the whole story to that oil drum, actually, which is fascinating. Anyway, it turned up, and it's a beautiful piece, but it has the Russian oil embossed on it at the top. And I then thought, well, what can I do about this? I wanted to do something about the oil and, you know, talking about the situation. And I'd been to the Francis Bacon exhibition, and right at the end, one of the last rooms, there was this one painting, and there, I actually don't know if it is this, but to me it looked like it was. It looked like there was a breast dripping blood or milk. But I just suddenly thought, of course, that's what it has to be. And it's the blood comes down through the blood transfusion bag through the breast. And obviously it's the sort of cliche of mother's milk and, you know, Russian. So yeah. And then the idea is that it would just keep dripping and it would just overflow and it would just be eventually just onto the floor and beyond and would just keep on.
And the war has also inspired you to do a plaster-filled sunflower.
Yeah. So that actually, UCL might, looking at whether they could show that, which would be amazing. So the idea of that is that there will be 1,000 sunflowers dipped in plaster. And of course, you know, the sunflower is the sort of emblem of hope and for Ukraine. But the reason for dipping it into the plaster, because I've dipped quite a lot of things in plaster, you know, it's taking away, it's sort of the barren and what's happening in the country. But the really interesting thing about it, as the plaster dries and cracks, you start to get a little peep through of the yellow. And it's sort of like the kind of bravery of the Ukrainian people that starts to come through still. So there will be 1,000 of them lying down. Because I was in the Ukraine-Polish borders the year before, and went around the camps around there talking to me. So very different to the other camps.
Let's talk a little bit about your process, Caroline. We're sitting next to your triptych of Tarik, and the portraits sort of gradually disappear, so that by the third one, his face is covered in all sorts of debris and so on. You know, that was really talking about the degenerative process, I suppose, of someone's life. And
yeah, it's seeing how the life, the sort of a person's life is just deconstructs and start to fall apart. I mean, obviously, this could be, we're reading it left to right, but actually, if you read it right to left, which would be more sort of an Arab sort of way of seeing things. So you could see that this is actually the beginning in the war zone, and as he comes out, it starts to. So you can kind of read it both ways. I work reductively, so everything comes from the blackness. So I black up the paper with really beautiful velvet charcoal, and then I use any kind of rubber. So my studio is more like going into like a sort of, you know, I don't know, hope like Leyland's or something, you know, than it is the studio. It's got everything there, anything that will rub out. So rubbers, sandpaper, bleach, anything. And then the triptych, they all have to be exactly the same to begin with. So they start off quite perfectly, and then I start to deconstruct them through any means. And then this one, I burnt wood, threw burnt embers at it, bits of...
Did the burnt wood represent a particular thing?
Well, just sort of, I suppose, just if you think about their country is lying in, you know, being bombed and in embers and deconstructed buildings, and just their whole life is breaking down. So it sort of is a signifier of that. And then, and the dust.
And how long does it take you to make one of these charcoal drawings?
The large ones, these are just 210 centimetres high. They take months. They take, and I mean months and months and months, maybe 6 months, 9 months.
And do you work from photos?
I work from frames from my video work. So I'll take a series of frames, and then you begin with that. So you make sure everything's in the right place, but then you have to put that aside, and they have to work as a drawing, not as just a reproduction of a photo. They have to work in their own right as a drawing. That's really important. So when you see them online, they're 2 centimeters high and they look like a photograph. But when you see them in the real, it's mark making, and you can see that. And the hands of the artist, I use just my fingers the whole time as well. So there's my kind of fingers all over it. I'm in there with it, if you like.
They're staggeringly beautiful, I must say. But as you say, they're beautiful, but they're also haunting as well. Why charcoal? Could you not do it in paint? Or is it simply because you're better at drawing?
Paint. I don't like colour, I find colour distracting, and I don't understand if it's really adding to anything for me. And charcoal, I love charcoal. I've always worked with, I'm a drawer. My first degree was drawing, and I love making it do things, and it's very malleable, and it's just the stuff that I do. You know, I don't think it matters what you make, whether you paint or draw or sculpture. It doesn't matter. It's that journey. When I was at Camberwell, they taught you that the journey between the beginning of the idea and the end, that journey in between, that process, that's what the art is about.
So your drawings will be very different then from the photo that you start off with?
It won't be the same, yeah. If I'd showed you the photo, yeah. I mean, you can see his face will be very much his face. I keep in touch with Tarek. He's always messaging me. When he sees the work being posted, he messages me. So, and in fact, I promised to send him some prints of the drawings because he asked for the drawings. And I said, well, you know, they've got to be exhibited and they're huge.
Do you have any particular influences artistically?
Yeah, I do really. I suppose when I originally, I would always look more at photographers and film. I'd look at, I looked a lot at Diane Arbus and Jeff Wall, actually, even though he's sort of constructed sets. And obviously Rembrandt, obviously you've got the Chiaroscuro. And then I look at Doris Lajolo. You know, it's interesting how people, I'm interested in how you show atrocity without necessarily showing it. But if you do show it, I've done another piece, which it's using awful footage and it's how to use it. In fact, if you look at the video that goes with Tarek, just to explain, you'll see these fractions that come in. You don't really understand what you're seeing, and they are really awful moments that we can't see because we've learned to put up these very sophisticated shields, if you like, against that kind of material. And we're so bombarded with these images, and you have to try and think of ways that you can get through to people that will allow them to spend time. And the drawings do that. The video work is very immediate. You know, it brings you in the space with it and you can't turn away from it. It can be very difficult.
Yeah, drawings are much more contemplative, aren't they? You have to sit in front of them for a long time, whereas video is over in a flash. And
also, I think when it's dealing with really difficult subject matters, people just turn away and can't spend time with it. Whereas the drawing or the painting, it allows that sense of distance. Yeah, as you say, almost meditative. You've got the hand of the artist in between you, and you can spend time with it and really think about what it's saying to you.
Do you see yourself as part of an historical continuum of people who depict people whose lives are on the margins?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. You know, that it's kind of, I was doing something to you with that Refugee Week actually last year, and it was about what is art? Now, art is many things, and there are many different art worlds, as we know. In the world that we live in now, where we're heading towards sort of disaster in so many different areas, is it enough to do art that is just a beautiful piece for your wall? Is that enough because it allows people to feel better, which is important, or better so that they then feel that they can do something about something else? Is it enough for the artist to do that? Or should the artist be doing work that does look at more sort of social political issues? Because we are in this state that we're in, I know what I think, that's not necessarily.
And what are you working on now, Caroline?
I'm always working on a series of small graphites, which I've got a triptych in the Trinity Boy Wolf Drawing Prize and touring around. They're very different. I do them in this very odd way, which kind of polishes them so they're almost like metal, and so they're very difficult to see as you go around them. You lose visibility of them. So I'm working on a series of those, which are going to have a show at Drawing Projects UK in Glasgow, their new space, at the end of the year, I hope. I'm off to Ireland to the National Music Hall at the end of this month with the installation. I'm doing something else with the installation, which we're going for funding, Arts Council funding, and then we're doing something with that and touring around with it, trying to speak to people about it. And I'm always working on the video work because the editing, it's like drawing. It's just like mark making, but with, each frame by frame. So yeah, it's quite a busy year.
Well, I really admire your commitment, and thanks so much for taking part in the podcast.
Thank you so much for inviting me. Thank you.
Caroline Burraway. And Caroline is also starting a project to bring attention to the plight of the Uyghur people in China, who the government have been accused of committing genocide against and other crimes against humanity, such as forced sterilization. That's it for this week. This is Bob Chaundy saying thank you for listening.